A note and correction about this week's episode before we begin. Throughout this episode, you'll hear us refer to the character of Liam Dempsey Jr. as Liam Gallagher or Liam Gallagher Jr. Obviously, we're confusing the character Liam Dempsey Jr. with the actor who plays him, John Gallagher Jr. So just know that we're talking about the character that is Liam Dempsey, played by John Gallagher Jr. We apologize for any confusion this has caused.
These violent delights have violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We're your hosts, Andrew Cersini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Unifowakin.
We just watched the second episode of Westworld's third season, titled The Winter Line. We assume you have as well, so total spoilers ahead. Before we do that, let's give you some online spots where you can get in contact with us. You can write it to us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod or just hashtag Violent Delights. Our Facebook page is at Westworld Podcast. Add us on iTunes and like us. Please leave us a review. We're going to dive into the after talk now. So, but before we do, this episode was written by Matt Pitts and Lisa Joy, directed by Richard J. Lewis, who had previously directed three other episodes of Westworld. And Dwayne, why don't you hit us up with the brief recap of this episode so we can get into the after talk?
Right. So this episode was narratively heavy. Here we go. We open where we left in last week's post-credit scene, in War World, with Maeve finding herself in the role of a British spy named Isabella. Hector, her lover, who's now in the role of an Italian partisan, finds her and fills her in best he can. They're stranded in Italy. They're meant to help the World War II allies avoid falling into a trap set by the World War II Axis powers. When stopped at a checkpoint, Maeve tries her skills of manipulation on the German soldiers, and it doesn't work. She discovers that her lover has been reprogrammed and is no longer aware. Once the loop plays out, Maeve realizes she's stuck, and she kills herself. Maeve wakes up to Felix working on her. He leaves her, so she's allowed to escape. Sylvester sees her and calls security. Before security can intervene, she runs into Sizemore, the narrative specialist. He's placed her in World War, it seems, because it's close to the forge where her daughter is. On her next loop through Italy, she says goodbye to Hector and abandons him to join Sizemore on a quest to the forge where she expects to meet her daughter, but where she learns that the Sizemore she's dealing with is actually a host, which has replaced the real Sizemore, who died some months ago. Upon hearing the truth, Sizemore's host's cognition begins to deteriorate. Maeve then believes that everyone working in the park is now being replaced by a host. We have a cutscene where we see a divergence that's recognized in the South China Sea by Rehoboam. Next, we find Bernard on a boat headed to Westworld. We finally get to see what it looks like from the outside. There are these giant sea gates that jut out from the water. Bernard makes it to Arnold's old lab beneath Ford's house, the whole what door space. There, he remembers killing Cullen, the old director of operations. He walks into a room which stored old, broken versions of Bernard or Arnold. There he finds Stubbs, the old head of the Westworld QA security force. Stubbs reveals that he's always been a host, and the last command he received was to give Bernard a chance to get out of there, Westworld, and then to kill himself. Bernard states that he returned to find Maeve since he believes that she alone is strong enough to stop Dolores. Stubbs agrees to take Bernard to Maeve. They arrive at the abandoned Mesa headquarters. Drone hosts maintain it while the board decides what to do with the space. They look for Maeve in the Vault of Hosts, but while they find her body, her brain ball, her chestnut, her pearl isn't there. Meanwhile, Maeve has begun to understand that she's been placed in a virtual setting, she calls a construct. It's not actually in Westworld or Delos. Maeve realizes that she can hack the simulation she's in and uses that to try to escape. She goes back into her loop in Worldworld after giving every one of the characters a copy of the map that's supposed to be a secret. It overloads the system and breaks this and slows it down to a crawl. While the simulation is in disarray, she hacks the maintenance bot in the real world to steal her command module, her brain ball, from the simulation system and then uses that bot to try to escape, but it's taken down. Back to Bernard and Stubbs. The two move up to Bernard's office where he realizes that Maeve's chestnut is not within the park. He does a scan of himself while Stubbs protects him from QA security that chances upon them. Stubbs gets Bernard to a skiff that can take him out of Westworld and back to the real world. Bernard reprograms Stubbs to be his protector in the real world, and the two leave together. Finally, Maeve awakens in an old industrial space, converted into a luxury home, where she meets Erenand Serac. He's given Maeve a body in the real world, but one that he can control if need be. And believing that their interests are aligned, he propositions her to kill Dolores Abernathy.
Dun, dun, dun. Thank you for that.
Sorry, I mean, there's so much like dropped in that episode.
Trying to
recap that was like short and sweet. It just wasn't going to happen. I apologize, people. I apologize.
No.
It's not one of those barn burner twists.
Yeah, we're still just when we had last week, we had a tongue twister like Rehoboam. This week we've got Enguerrand Serac. So it's like, what the? Come on, give me a break, guys. All right, so
yeah, I mean, I'm kind of glad that Vincent Cassell, like, he's able to use like French names, like they don't call him Bob.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, I respect the fact that the man's like, I'm French. I'm not gonna not be French. I'm not like those guys in England who pretend to be American. Just give me a French name. Let's move on here.
Yeah. Like, he can say it, so it's fine. Yeah. So my initial impressions of this episode is I felt, you know, we've had episodes of Westworld in the past where we felt they were a little like filler. I'm not going to say this was filler because there was a lot of lore going on in this episode, but I felt like it felt a little sort of fan service-y because we had like the return of Sizemore, Felix, Sylvester, Stubbs. You had like this very obvious nod to Game of Thrones in there.
What's Dragon?
Right. We return to the locations like Escalante and the Forge. These are all locations and characters that we thought we were completely done with in season two, and the fact that they feel a little manipulated in here by
the producers who are like, you need to use these sets that we built for you last year,
right? Or we you know, we gotta get Felix and Sylvester back in here, we gotta get Stubbs up and running again, we, you know, we killed Sizemore in the last episode, but can we have some sort of, it felt very contrived to me, like almost like a fan fiction written episode. But I will say that I continue to be amazed and pleasantly amazed at how straightforward the narrative is in these first two episodes. I mean, there's nothing really confusing. It was pretty much like cross-cutting between a very clearly told scene to clearly told scene. I didn't feel like there was anything obfuscating or confusing here.
But weren't you for a second expecting that there might be, like, this all had the patterns of an episode that could have something that was very obfuscated, but they decided not to go down that path.
I feel like, mm-hmm. I don't know, I was just you can go ahead. I'll just say what I have to say afterward. Go ahead, answer his question.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like a very intentional choice not to go, like, we could twist things around with you. We've got this construct within this world. We don't know who is who. We don't know if Sizemore is real or not. And then it felt like very intentionally hyper aware of the fact that we don't want to do that to you this time around. We're just going to play it straight and tell you what's going on right on the surface.
Yeah, and so for me, I feel like I'm agreeing with what you're saying. I do feel like there's some things that wanted to get tied up. So if season three is indeed a kind of like reboot, if it wants to be free of the past, it has to kind of like tie up some loose ends in the past, right? So seeing Felix, seeing Sylvester, it's like, oh, okay, they exist. Oh, wait, they don't exist. That was kind of a bit of a throw you for a loop. But then this idea that, like, okay, we saw Sizemore get shot, and it was kind of an ignominious end for a character that kind of meant a lot. You know, he had grown. In my world, he kind of became like a Boromir. He was a complete and utter jerk, and then he redeemed himself. And then here we see him again. I'm like, oh, okay, he's back. He's got a limp, whatever. And then we find out that he's a fake, right? And that was pretty interesting. For me, I feel like they're racing toward a confrontation. You know, there are 8 or 9 episodes this season,
and they need to get to a place where there's a confrontation between Dolores and Maeve in the real world that has the fate of the world in its balance, right? And they're racing toward that, which is why this is definitely a building episode. It needed to be straightforward. Yes, we saw classic Worst War characters show up, and I think that's in part because of the reboot thing. Last week, last episode, it was so different that while it grounded us in the new reality, this second episode is presented to us with something familiar, you know, loops in a Westworld Delos Park, reminding us that this is in fact the same series. So I feel like they were doing some things to build foundation here, build foundation that Maeve is independent and powerful, regardless of her, like, you know, the kind of superpowers that she kind of gave herself when she was out in her other body. They were giving us foundation that that there is a big bad, or there's another faction. That faction itself is powerful because it had, you know, a simulation of Westworld that Maeve couldn't even figure out in the beginning. And, you know, then there's this idea that, like, Bernard and Stubbs, you know, Hobbs and Shaw are on the move. So I feel like it was a big foundational episode, and we'll be able to see some things happen in the future.
Yeah, for me, this felt like this harkened to somewhat of season two episodes where it was just very sort of video gamey, and you had that sort of element of, you know, of people trying to track down the various items that they needed and trying to get to the next level or figure out the underlying mystery.
So I
think that was a part of this episode in general that made it a very sort of easy to watch and easy to go through, and I really enjoyed Thandie Newton's central role, as she is just a phenomenal actor.
Oh man, I gotta say, I was very pleased to see her running things again.
Why am I not surprised?
I mean, she's good. She's good. She's like 48 and good. You know, she's great.
She's 47.
47, even better. Yeah, so, I'm just saying she's great. She's great. She held the episode together herself. I think what's going on with Bernard and Stubbs was also interesting because Bernard's character has never been a leader, even though he was running. He was a partner, so to speak, in Westworld. He was never a leader, and now his character is being forced to do some leading. Yeah. You know, like, oh, I'm going to make this decision about Stubbs. You know, he's confronting his responsibility to go and talk to and deal with Dolores, which we'll talk about later in the big picture. But yeah, I think that was also key. So, you know, Maeve being like, okay, I'm Maeve. I'm never not going to be aware. I'm sad that my boyfriend's not aware anymore, and that, you know, Sizemore is a construct or whatever. But at the same time, like, I got to do what I got to do. So I like that in charge attitude. But yeah, those are initial impressions. Not to get too deep.
All right, let's talk about some of the salient points about this episode. Let's start with the title, The Winter Line. I had to look this up on Wikipedia because I was not aware, but it made perfect sense once I saw it. So the Winter Line was a series of German and Italian military fortifications in Italy constructed during World War II, designed to defend a western section of Italy. Major battles on the Winter Line resulted in 98,000 Allied casualties and 60,000 Axis casualties. So a point of great conflict during World War II in Italy, which is...
A line is drawn as well, right? So you have to draw the line and say, right, here's where we're going to try to stop them. And indeed, they stopped them to, you know, a 40,000... casualty difference. So that's the thing. And if
I was trying to put together what the connection was to the overall narrative of Westworld, but I think you just hit on it right now.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a line being drawn in the real world between Gallagher and Serac, right? They both pulled out. I mean, Gallagher is unaware of Dolores, but Serac has brought out Maeve. And Maeve is his winter line, you know?
Oh.
His winter soldier, so to speak.
Well, given his control over her body, I think you have a really tight point right there, right? Yeah. The Winter Soldier was one that the pretend Soviets of the Marvel era under under not Shield. What's Spectre? What's the bad guys? what's the bad guys in the MCU? You know what I'm talking about?
Thanos?
Hydra.
Hydra. Hydra. Yes, Hydra.
So the guys in the Hydra have control over the soldier's body, and the soldier is formidable, and that's what Maeve is. I mean, the idea that Maeve has complete control was just stopped by a hand, you know, like basically like a slideshow controller.
Sure.
Like click. You can't move.
Sure.
That was, and this look in her face when she realized that. Ooh, yeah. So, there's that. So,
one of the things I found pretty interesting was Bernard returning back to Westworld. So he's returning to the island. He's returning to all these locations that he's seen burnt down, and coming back to kind of face the realities of his demons. We even see him walk specifically through the room that has a bunch of his own images, the images of his own hosts. And then he comes into contact with Stubbs, who he at this moment learns is also a host. And
was anyone surprised that Stubbs was the host?
You know, that was one of those things that had always sort of been, we've always been suspicious of that fact, but, and I was okay. Actually, I was on the fence either way. I would have been, because he had sort of made references in season one.
Isn't very good. So like, thought he was a robot.
In season one, he's made references to his cornerstone, or you know, he's made joking references to Elsie about him being a host. But I thought he was just sort of, you know, making like a meta joke, and I think maybe he thought he was too. But it turns out this was the episode that we finally, after two seasons, finally got the confirmation that Stubbs is a host.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. He said he always knew he was a host.
Interesting.
Right? So when he's making those jokes, I mean, it seems like he always knew he was a host. He got the last instruction, and then he was trying to shoot, when he shot himself, he was trying to shoot himself in a way that would effectively blow his head off, right?
Yeah.
So he knew he was a host, and that was... That's I think the only twist in here is that he wasn't one of those hosts like, oh my god, I'm a host. What is my life? He's like, this is what I am, this is what I'm supposed to do. And I thought it was clever when Bernard changed his directive, he's like, you could have just asked for my help. So he's as aware
as a
Maeve or Dolores in knowing what he is and how he fits into the universe. The difference is he wasn't built with roles that involved cornerstone memories and like the manipulation of having to be messed with by, you know, guests all the time, you know?
Right.
He doesn't have that kind of trauma. And because he doesn't have that kind of trauma...
Well, he does now at the end of this episode.
He does at the end of the episode for sure. But I feel like he's, you know, there's a certain like male privilege kind of, right? Like he's like, he's got free privilege. Like he's always known what he is. And so he never had to like think about it. Whereas, Dolores and Maeve have had to constantly question who they are and how they fit in, which is kind of,
probably,
you know, so that was pretty big.
Dwayne, what about, Enguerrand Serac?
Enguerrand Serac. I mean, it's a fun name to say. So, I did some looking around, and all I could really find was information about Serac, right? Mm-hmm. So Yeshua ben Serac, or Yeshua is also Joshua in English. He wrote the Book of Serac, commonly known as Ecclesiasticus, which is a kind of long meditation on Hebrew fidelity. According to, it's a long meditation of Hebrew fidelity. And in the book, Serac seeks to revive the memory of the historical consciousness of his people in order to show his own identity and the perennial value of the traditions of the Hebrew people. The book is addressed to everyone who wanted to behave like Jews in a changing world, and it is the work of a lucid conservative who wants to preserve the essential, knowing that new situations should not be ignored. And this is, I'm going to shout out to Crow F. Saboya on Reddit for putting that together. I mean, I looked around and I saw all this stuff about Ecclesiasticus, and mm-hmm. I was like, man, I got to put together a whole bunch of paragraphs on that. But this guy, Crow Saboya, he just did it tightly on Reddit, so it's good. Others did note that Enguerrand is an old Norman name. That's like French Norman. That is to say, like William the Norman, William the Conqueror, who kind of took over England back in 1066. That kind of, not like Norwegian, but like Norman. And it's a name you don't find being used anymore, but it was an old noble name from back in the day.
So maybe Serac is like a noble. His character is meant to represent like a noble.
Or at least entitled, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least entitled. But it also sounds like, you know, he's the guy who is the architect of the Rehoboam. And so he, the idea that he wants to maintain its historical consciousness, the idea that he wants to keep it, you know, its fidelity, and that he doesn't really know what's going on with it, but something's not working right. The Serac name really works for the character, at least so far. One more thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
I know it's a simulation with wealthy guests visiting, you know, War World.
Sure.
Kind of theory. But this is a pet peeve of mine in every single sort of European theater World War II setting on film and TV. You know, like, the baddies are there and they're, like, you know, about to fight. And no matter what, it could be the most, like, podunk little tiny town. There's always some giant, like, Nazi swastika banner that's, like, perfectly red, perfectly white, and perfectly black. There's no dust on it or anything. And when do you have time to throw these things up? Like, who's sewing these things? You know, like, where are these things
coming from?
Well,
they just carry around Nazi banners around with them for, you know, whenever they take over a town. They've got, like, dozens of Nazi banners.
Sure, I'm just saying, like, who's like, okay, like, make sure you got the banners, because we're going to, it's like,
there's the Nazi version of Betsy Ross, who's, you know, in her basement.
Did they just task sewing all the ladies in the World War II
sure.
occupied yeah. places to make Nazi banners? It's just so weird how these banners are everywhere. Also, I just feel like, you know, Italy was hanging out with the Nazis and the Axis.
Yeah.
I don't ever recall seeing an Italian banner anywhere. It's always the German stuff. So it's always a weird thing. But speaking of the Winter Line and the banners, one of the things that I really liked about this episode, and this is like a tiny little moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, whenever you're watching like a Marvel movie and Black Widow takes somebody down, she like kind of jumps on their shoulders and clamps her legs around them and like spins and then they fall down.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like incredible moves. This moment in the beginning where Maeve shoves the poison pill into the eye of the German was so badass, right? Like, Maeve is wearing heels. She's in, like, a long skirt that doesn't allow her to do a lot of stuff. And instead of having to, like, you know, pull out a gun or whatever, she straight up just shoves this poison pill right into this guy's eye, which would kill him if he were a human, for sure. But also is one of those things you just don't expect. And
I love the whole thing where Hector's like, this pill will kill instantly. And it does, but not in the way that you think.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a little bit more about Maeve later on. But it's you can already see from that, you know, perspective, that period, that she does things her own way. She does things differently, and she'll sort of hack the system.
You notice that when we met Hector, he's been retasked as Ettore, which is, of course, the Italian version of the name Hector. So,
which is interesting because you are Andrew Sorsini, whose roots tied to Mexico but are clearly Italian. So, like, yeah. Hector, Ettore, you know, that, you know, like you're saying.
I see your point.
Yeah, I'm glad you pulled that one out. I like some lines here. Maeve meets Sizemore. She says, they shot you. He's like, half a dozen times. Just happy they missed my heart. And then this line she drops, like, cunning of you to make it so compact a target. Like, talk about a burn. And one of those, like, British burns, right?
Right, right. But what, I mean, I thought that was kind of, like, mean. I mean, he obviously...
It was mean.
He redeemed himself at the end of season two, and then she has to mm-hmm. come up on him with a burn like that. I mean, come on.
I know it was so good. I had to like hit that 10-second back thing to hear it again because she says it so perfectly quietly, you know, and she doesn't even use like small heart. She's like, you know, small. She's like compact. You have to lean in and hear what she's saying. You're like, ooh. Ooh, that's pretty good. She's got another good line in here, and this is when she realizes Sizemore's not Sizemore. You know, Sizemore goes and he like kisses her, which is just weird. And she's like, "You didn't help me because you desired me or wanted something in return. You helped me because it was the right thing to do," which actually reminded me of Hector, because Hector helped her because he desired her.
Right, right. Right.
Sizemore became Boromir, so to speak, because He did it was because it was only the right thing to do. He was never looking for a reward in that. Once she was like, there's this moment in season two, she's like, take off your clothes, put on these other clothes. And it's like he took off his clothes and he puts on these other clothes and he becomes a different person. And he recognizes what he's supposed to be doing. He has literally been put in someone else's shoes, and those shoes are the characters that he had to create, which he used to create mercilessly. And so I thought that was pretty powerful. But yeah, it was really cool.
So I noticed that also when Sizemore's interrogating Maeve and she questions him about who he is or the nature of his being, he starts to seize up, and doing that causes the entire construct to start to reveal itself. In a way that's sort of an extension of the idea that she's overtaxing the construct. She's overtaxing the construct by causing Sizemore to question himself, or the Sizemore construct within the construct to question itself. So in that way, even without her her sort of host controlling powers as a physical form, she still has her very being, her very essence still has powers even within this construct. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that was pretty tight, especially because it was like, what's going on here? Is it Maeve's? Is Maeve not seeing things right? Is Sizemore not seeing things right? You know, and then they kind of, and this is one of the things with the episode, telling it, you know, calling it straight, is that while that's a bit confusing, it becomes very clear very quickly what's going on, and it was a good visual way to tell the story. So I thought that was pretty powerful. But yeah, there's a callback. Speaking of stories, there's a callback to the original movie, right, Andy?
Yeah, yeah. So in the original 1974 Westworld film, there are three worlds. There's Westworld, Roman world, and medieval world. And as we've seen in this episode, when Stubbs and Bernard go to what they call Park 4, it appears to be a medieval world. And we see there the dragon from Game of Thrones, which I believe is Drogon, right? Maybe you can correct me on that, Dwayne.
I think it was, I don't think it was I think it was Rhaegal, because Drogon's Rhaegal. Black, and that one seemed red. Yeah.
That dragon seems to be a one part of it, and you have these two techs who are, quote, sitting around seeing if they get laid off. And talking about selling it to a startup in Costa Rica, which I'm fairly certain when they're referring to a startup in Costa Rica, that is a callback to the fictional company InGen from Jurassic Park, which is another Michael Crichton property. So a little
right. In fact, Michael Crichton property that pretty much succeeded Westworld. You know, the idea of a park where the attractions go wild and start killing people, but done in a way that was more attractive than the Westworld situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Another amusement park gone awry.
Exactly. So finally, here in the Salient Points, you guys know the saying, they don't make them like they used to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens all the time.
You
buy a new hammer or something, and like it's not, you hammer something, and like the hammer top falls off from the stick because it doesn't work.
They don't make them like they used to.
They don't make them like they used to. And I'm astounded that in the future, in like the 2250s, in a world today where everything feels cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, maintenance droids like Harriet, the thing that Maeve took over from the inside to steal her brain ball, right? It's somehow immune to submachine gun fire, right?
Up to a certain point, right? And then
Sure. I'm saying,
you mean L3? Is that what you're talking about? That droid?
Yeah, the droid that was basically grabbing her brain ball and making a run for it. Here's the thing. So, like, when it comes to most robots we have today, most machines we have today, if you shoot a bullet in it, it stops working, much like a human being, right? But in this future, it takes multiple bullets to take out everything. Like, you would think that if we made a robot today, if we made a fully humanoid, you know, robot android today, we'd probably make it so that unless you're the military,
you'd make it so that if it's just a civilian operating in a workplace, whatever, that if you hit it with a bat, it would go down because God forbid something happen and it starts, you know, it does the wrong thing. But yet they make this maintenance droid, and it took a ridiculous amount of submachine gun fire. Like, there were whole clips emptied into that thing, right? And also, when people started shooting at it, they were shooting at that thing wild. Like, they were, some people were in a room, and it's walking through this room to get out, and they just start opening fire, and they're like regular people in the room with it. It's not like they tried to isolate it. Even today, cops would be like, okay, I don't want a stray bullet to hit somebody else. But these private security guys are crazy, to the point where at the end, they circle it. They encircle the beast, the robot, and they start shooting it. And everybody knows that standing in a circle and shooting at the same thing means you're going to shoot your friends on the other side of the circle. It's just like, really, I feel like they needed some violence here, and they went really hardcore to get it, and it just seemed kind of ridiculous, right?
They were shooting down towards Harriet on the ground, so there wouldn't be a lot of crossfire. But I think also this was a robot that seemed to be a riot control robot that was retasked as a security guard. So I can imagine that.
Why have all the security guards there?
It's an interesting place to skim on costs, right? You know, it's like, I repurpose that, when you just get a Roomba instead. You know, it's like, it might be cheaper options, but I don't know. People in the future, you know, we've learned from even the first episode how technology is still not the greatest. You know, maybe there's some other precautions that you'd think people would start taking, given that place like Westworld just had an epidemic, right? Mm-hmm. So, but...
Yeah, I just thought it was really funny how it's like, okay, we're going to have this riot control robot, but then we're going to have 10 men with submachine guns just lying around. Go for it. I don't know. Anyway, so that's a question I had, but there's a bunch of unanswered questions. Let's get to them.
Unanswered questions. One question I have is, so we tonight, in this week's episode, we saw War World. My question for you is, since we only saw War World in a virtual construct, did War World ever actually physically exist on the island that the Westworld is located on, or did it only ever exist in this construct?
Like, they would have had to, so I'm guessing it exists in the real world, and here's why. They would have had to insinuate and install in Maeve's brain ball.
Yeah.
A familiarity with War World. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me like what they didn't want to do, right? Like, since they knew so much about Westworld already,
sure,
they could have just put her back in Westworld. They could have put her in Shogun World. They could have put her in the Raj. But instead, they put her in World World. And I feel like, you know, why would they go through all that trouble when they're trying to find something out from her anyway? They want to put her in something that was familiar enough to her,
yeah,
so that, yeah, that's all I'm thinking.
Another question I had is, so Bernard and Stubbs are in this Park 4. I guess my obvious question here is Park 4 actually medieval world, as in from the original Westworld movie? Because it sure seems like it.
I think that's fair, it's a good thing. We've got so we know that there's the Raj, we know the Shogun.
Yeah.
We know there's medieval world, and we know there's Westworld for sure. And War World is it's an open question.
Yeah.
You know, we think that it exists, but it's an open question. So
I think
Delos, something for everybody.
I think that leaves, because in Delos Destinations, there are 6 parks. And I think that means we've accounted for every park except for Park 5. Which we don't know what that is. So,
Roman world,
huh?
You know, like in the movie Roman World.
Roman World, maybe.
Was it Roman World? Classical world?
Maybe. I don't know. Well, there was Roman World. There was Future World. Although it seems to me like it would be redundant to have a Future World in a series set in the future of 2058.
Right. Exactly. Delos Destinations is it says park offline, so there's that.
Yeah.
Hey, one question that I kind of have.
Yeah.
And I know we talked about it last episode, but we keep seeing more and more red here.
Yeah.
We've got Maeve's dress. We've got the
car. What
was red
last episode?
The lunchbox that Caleb had was red, and I believe the robot there might have been red too. But
yeah, red and black.
It's very, like, it's super distinct, and I wonder if there's going to be some sort of tie-in to or tie-togetherness by the time we reach the end of this season. Any thoughts?
It's a nice accent color in a bland world. So I think that's a big piece of it. But yeah, I don't have anything yet. So there's that. I will say red is interesting. The car you mentioned is interesting. Because, so, you know, Hector and Maeve, they go to the car, right? Then they drive the car, and they get to the airstrip. And the first thing they do when they get out of the car is they get out, and then they, like, take their time to close the doors. And I'm not going to lie. If I'm running from, like, Nazis behind me, I'm going to open the door of the car, and then I'm going to run. But they, like, sit there. They're like, okay, let me close the door. It's a classic car, you know, it's from the 1930s.
You don't want to ruin it.
Close the door. I guess it's
even though it's a even though it's a fake car inside a construct that isn't real anyway.
Even so, it's like, okay, so today's cars, right? Like, let's say you had a 2010 car.
Yeah.
And you left the door open. The ceiling light would probably be on, and you'd be worried about the battery dying. This car is so old that by the 2250s, the car's like 120 years old. Right?
I mean, the simple explanation is that her construct was programmed to close the door. So
I guess it's just one of those weird things that just happens. Yeah. Why are you closing doors of a getaway car? It's a getaway car. It's ridiculous. Anyway, let's get to the question that we asked last week.
Yeah.
Who are the hosts? There were five chestnuts or pearls in Hale's bag, right?
Mm-hmm.
We knew that Hale was definitely in there, right? Because
No, not Hale.
I'm sorry.
Dolores?
Hale's gone.
Hale's
Dolores,
gone.
Dolores was in Hale's body in that moment.
Yeah.
Right? We can assume Connell's was in there because she had to, like, make a Connell's later, right?
No. Somebody is in Connell's. Somebody that's
right.
Not Connell's.
So whoever's
is in Connell's.
Whoever's in Connell's yes. was in that bag, right? Bernard was in that bag.
Sure.
She woke him up and said, we can't be friends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, was Maeve in that bag, too?
Hmm.
Or did Serac grab her chestnut, her brain ball, on his own?
I think
we'll
that's
get into
it.
That more deeply later, but that's a question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's worth asking. One thing that got me when I was watching the very beginning of the episode was that Maeve and Hector were basically, we know they're hosts, and yet they were playing a scenario that felt like what a guest would play around hosts, you know, sneaking around the Nazis, trying to get to the airport, trying to get to the airstrip, warning the Allies. That seems to me like the kind of quest that a guest would have in a place like War World.
Well,
and
I mean, I think
it threw me off a little bit. That was their, that these hosts were trying to outrun other hosts, as opposed to, like, if there was, like, an NPC, right? Like, Hector was he felt like an NPC because he was, and then there was a guest that was working with him. I don't know. It just felt like Maeve's role didn't feel like the role of a host.
I think two things there. First of all, we've seen from previous episodes of Westworld that all of these hosts are on these loops, these narrative loops that they believe are real, and they have their own agendas. And secondly, since the intention of this entire construct seems to be to keep Maeve occupied within this construct and possibly get information out of her from the construct of Sizemore, it would make sense that her role feels more like a host within this simulation. I mean, feels more like a guest within the simulation.
I get that. So I guess it threw me off in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
to the point where when I discovered, you know, obviously as they revealed to you that it's a fake place.
Yeah.
I wasn't as surprised as I thought I would, because it just was weird that Maeve was kind of doing a guest's role in the beginning.
Yeah. So one big overarching question that I have here, this is probably more of a big picture thing, but So the question is, who is on the side of right here, Liam Gallagher Jr. or Enguerrand Serac? We've seen in episode one and in episode two, we've seen both of their sides, and we've seen how Serac believes that he has created Rehoboam to
make the world a better place.
To give history an author, as he puts it, and to make the world a better place for humanity. He also believes that the war has already been lost, so he's just trying to, being someone who's invested in the future, he's trying to make sure that humanity still has a place in that world.
He did say that there were, humanity's history was one of kind of tripping from one crisis to another.
Right.
And given where we are right now,
yeah,
in this moment with, you know, COVID-19, the coronavirus, whatever you want to call it, I gotta say, I know they made this, you know, 18 months ago or longer, but I was like, man, you guys really like, you know, there's some catharsis there.
Yeah.
If there were a planner that was gonna help us figure out how to get, you know, like the singularity is coming, that kind of thing, like something that was looking at the data and saying, here are the risks, let's work against these risks, that would feel good. So while I don't want a centrally planned anything, I understand why in this science fiction setting it's so appealing.
But still the question remains, who do you feel should be rooting for here, Serac or Gallagher?
Well, Vincent Cassell, neither. Right. So on the one hand, Vincent Cassell is always evil, so there's that. But I would say that the central question of science fiction, and this is, you know, there's no doubt this is speculative science fiction,
sure,
is not necessarily saying who's right and who's wrong, a la Star Wars, which is science fantasy. But it's to say, here are different perspectives. Let's leave you with them both, so you have to think about what would be right in your space, or the fact that neither of them are right. What's your third way?
Should artificial intelligences completely take over civilization, or does humanity still have a place in civilization? I think is probably the synthesis of that.
Ask Star
question.
Trek Picard.
Right, yeah. Right. There's a lot of thematically similar conflicts going on in science fiction, modern science fiction these days.
Well, I'll tell
ultimately,
you this.
Ultimately, I think we are all on Team Bernard because Amherst College. So
yes, there you go. Team Bernard is where we're at. I will say this: Westworld to me, has been focused on a question that science fiction has asked multiple times. If you watch everything from AI in 2001 all the way through to what's the one with Ava?
Ex Machina.
Ex Machina, right? Ex Machina in 2014 or 15 or whenever that came out.
Yeah.
The question has been like, we create these beings, we abuse these beings. What's going to happen with these beings once they realize they're being abused, right? And I think Westworld is trying to deeply explore that paradigm and be the quintessential piece of that paradigm.
Right.
So I think Westworld and maybe Battlestar Galactica are doing it the most tightly. And when I say that, I mean it's so difficult to tell the difference between a robot and artificial intelligence and a human, a normal human, that you have to begin to wonder why we treat these beings that way. And there's this moment, I'm going to steal from what I was thinking later, where Maeve says, if there's one thing I know about human nature, it's that your stupidity is only eclipsed by your laziness. And that is the entire premise of not only this show, but almost every single science fiction, robot, artificial intelligence conflict in the history of the genre. So I feel you asking who's on the side of right, who should we be rooting for. It'll be revealed on some level. But I think right now it's enough to know that, you know, you've got this giant artificial supreme intelligence hanging the balance. There's two people trying to control it. And one person that we've just met has said he believes there's a better way forward. And that way forward is to not stumble from catastrophe to catastrophe, and that's what the artificial intelligence can do for him. Right? Now, obviously, the road to good intentions is paved with terribleness. That's not the right. phrase.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Thank you. So,
well, we're going, we won't need no roads.
Oh, see, there you go. The other trope of science fiction, time travel. So I think we're not in a place where we can answer that question just yet, but I think it's worth asking and worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah, so one question I have is we've seen in a lot of the trailers and footage, as well as at the end of this episode, where it ultimately feels like they are, you know, going to try and pit Maeve against Dolores, or they're setting that up pretty hard. But the big question is, do you think Maeve will actually ultimately be against Dolores, or might she join sides? There was a point in season 2, episode 1, when Maeve is rescuing Sizemore, and Sizemore is like complaining about how crazy the world is and asks if Maeve did it. And she says, no, but I bet I share the same sensibilities of whoever did that. And of course, we know that being Dolores. So while they are kind of pushing them as opponents, it would be kind of interesting to see if they ultimately work together.
I think you're right. What we've seen so far is a narrative pushing them into a conflict. I feel like the narrative's almost racing for there to be a conflict. But I think the obvious twist would be one of them realizing that they're not on actual opposite sides. The question there then is, you've got your Maeve and you've got your Dolores, these two different factions. But then in the middle of it, you've got Bernard, who believes that Dolores brought him back because on some level, she understands that she might go too far and she needs to check on herself. So with Maeve presumably complying with Serac and becoming the opposition to Dolores and Stubbs behind Bernard, we might find a bit of a Mexican standoff of a sort where Maeve and Dolores are on opposite sides and Bernard is in the middle. Now, the question then becomes, can Bernard bring them together?
So
Bernard seems to be a bring together kind of guy.
Here's the thing, is that we saw in this episode when Bernard was accessing his memories that he remembered Dolores saying, it will take both of us to survive, but not as friends. So what if, here's a big what if Dolores's grand scheme involved pitting Bernard against her to go get Maeve, to bring Maeve back to join forces with Dolores ultimately. Like this is all part of a grand scheme to get...
That's a mind job, dude. Hold on.
That's what I'm saying, man. I mean, Dolores actually programmed Bernard, so she has...
Yes and no. So we don't really know that. We do know that Bernard was able to do a relatively clean diagnostic, that it got cut off at the last minute, so we don't know what the complete...
But we saw Dolores programming Bernard at the end of season 2, episode 10.
We know that she gave him some instructions.
Yes.
We don't know that she put something... Like, he's looking for corruption. He's looking for whatever she may have done to him.
Yeah.
And I feel like, at the end of the day, the whole point of what's happening with Bernard is that Dolores trusts his judgment. Like, Bernard never abused her. Bernard always wanted her to be better, and she's recognizing that.
Hmm.
And so I think, if anything, the twist is a non-twist. That she trusts his judgment. She's just like, we can't be like same place, same time.
Interesting.
Over here.
I think we will see which one of those bears out to be true by the end of this season. whether it's Bernard being set against Dolores because she doesn't trust herself, or this is all part of Dolores's master scheme to get Maeve roped in to assist her.
Right. Maybe it is. I mean, at the end of the day, I feel like Dolores is bent on hate. And
yeah.
While Maeve certainly doesn't have any love for humanity, she's kind of bent on love for her daughter. So there's a nice contrast there. Whereas Bernard is kind of like, he's just a very lost being.
So,
you know?
So to wrap this whole unanswered question section up, probably the biggest question of the entire series, what is the square root of negative one?
Okay, so that's not the question of the entire series. Just to put it out there. But
I feel like with Maeve, basically did was the equivalent of taking a pocket calculator and entering one of those figures in that comes out with, like, you know, negative infinity number. It basically breaks the computer.
I do like the fact that what happened visually in the show is that in the Upside Down, you know, in the world where they administer the management side, right.
The body shop,
they're all these very rational people. Had never, you know, they're construct people. They never actually dealt with having to have this discussion. They end up all having this discussion and slowing down the machine. And then on the inside of War World,
yeah,
they've got all these maps, and the AI in there doesn't know how to deal with the fact that everybody's a traitor,
right?
And so, I love the fact that that was the way she slowed things down. Like, yeah. They're writing so well for that character, that it's clever that she was able to pull that off. And I mean, all of us have worked with virtual machines. I mean, Tosin, you were at Box. We had virtual machines everywhere. So the idea of, like, slowing down a virtual machine by giving it a problem that it can't handle, it's fantastic.
Well, I think the other interesting thing, right, and not to get too meta there, but these are all constructs, all imaginary constructs, all hosts trying to figure out who they are, right? Who am I? And Maeve is the only one who seems well-rooted in who she is.
Who knows who
she's hardware seller too, right?
Yes.
So, like, they're running it off her hardware. The rest of them are just part of the software. And what is software if not imaginary?
I think that's a great place to transition to our big picture here. So in this section, we're going to talk about the overarching themes of the entire series, the entire season, and the entire series so far. I'd like to start off with, we've had
I'm afraid I can't do that for you.
Oh my God, my artificial assistant is taking over. Stop it.
Yes, Siri.
Yeah, that's Siri. Speaking of, so we've had in this season so far all of these references to biblical characters like Rehoboam and Solomon and Sirach, which you said had a ecclesiastical background.
Yes, that book. Yep.
So all of these references to biblical characters remind me of The Matrix, the movie The Matrix, and particularly the sequels to The Matrix. Which attempted to...
Even in the original movie, they were on the ship, the Nebuchadnezzar.
Right. Right. They attempted to sort of create these analogs to biblical characters and situations that matched the situations that were going on in the future of The Matrix, which I thought was a really interesting... It's an interesting similarity, and I wonder if... how aware the showrunners are that they're doing this and that it seems kind of obvious that they're doing it.
So my
my
composition writing teacher back in college, Judith Frank, go Amherst, she would say that everything is intentional at this level. So that's worth noting here. I think it's pretty intentional. They're trying to tell a story that is epic in its scale. And one of the ways to do that is to link it to other epic stories.
All the things that
are relatively decent job.
Like all the things that have happened before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to get Battlestar Galactica about it, but yeah.
Yeah, and I know we talked about this before the show, but the, you know, Sirach and his nice, you know, white uniform reminding of.
Right.
The guy in The Matrix, the architect?
The architect.
Yeah, he's the architect. I also thought that Maeve wearing the white dress at the end of it puts her in a position to be a white hat.
Right. Well, we saw at the end of season of last episode, Dolores is in a black dress.
Mm-hmm. And so, she's a black hat. She's trying to destroy all humanity. So there's that.
And speaking of white hat characters and black hat characters, you have Sirach, who in this meeting where he is attempting to entice Maeve to join him on his quest, he's actually eating an apple, like the apple of the tree of knowledge. It's like he's like the in the role of the serpent, essentially enticing her to join him.
Not bad. I like it. I like it. I think that's definitely worth thinking about as we move forward, these references, because they want us to think about good and evil. They want us to think about what it means to have knowledge and what it means not to have that knowledge. I think that's key. Side note, Maeve uses the term construct to talk about the virtual world she's in, where it's not even that Sizemore's a host. It's that he is a software creation of Sizemore. And what's interesting about that is the term construct was used to describe the virtual space in the Matrix that people used to figure out and kind of gear up, get what they wanted before they went actually into the Matrix.
Yeah.
And to train. So, you know, Maeve is learning what she is and, you know, who she is a little bit when she's inside the world, which is in the construct. Neo learns everything when he's in the construct. And he uses that in the real world, so that's worth mentioning.
Pushing bullets around, that Maeve does
right?
too.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there's something there. Serac is presumably the man leading the faction on the other side of Rehoboam, and he's actually confused about what's going on with his artificial intelligence.
Right.
Whereas, you know. On the other side of the thing, what's his rival's name?
Gallagher.
Gallagher Jr., right? So he's like, I don't have power. Those guys have power. I'm going to pout about it. Serac is like, yeah, we have power, but we have a problem here.
Right.
And it's revealed to us that the machine is not working as they think it should be working.
Yeah.
It's behaving strangely. And we have to wonder why that is. So that's worth noting.
Didn't Serac's assistant in episode one mention that someone had broken into the system?
There's a problem with the
system. There's a problem with the system.
So they were wondering if the reason for the problem was some sort of security breach.
Yeah.
On Gallagher's side.
So here's a big question. It didn't seem because Dolores was spying on
Ford.
Okay, so you're predicting the question I'm going to ask. So Dolores is spying on that conversation as if she wasn't aware that there was a break-in, and Serac, we've discovered, thinks that the break-in is Dolores, or he thought that it was Maeve, and he learned that it wasn't Maeve, and now he thinks it's Dolores. So if it's not Dolores and it's not Maeve, then who is responsible for this break-in of Rehoboam? And
who knows Kung Fu, right? Because maybe it's Maeve, maybe it's Dolores.
No, not like a real break-in, Tosin, like a hack.
Yeah, I'm talking about a hack, you know, when they upload the code to your brain and learn all this martial arts stuff.
I know Kung Fu. Whoa. Dwayne, you think that maybe it's Ford behind all this?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it were Bernard himself, right? Like, hey, I'm the guy. Because Bernard is always surprising himself.
But I hope it's Ford.
I mean, we'd like to see Ford again, and that would make a lot of sense for us. Ford bringing everybody together, right?
Yeah.
So that could be a thing. But I don't want to make a true prediction. I'd rather just have it unfold.
Sure.
But I like that there's mystery here, because we are talking about how the season feels a little straightforward with the storytelling.
Yeah.
And less mystery box. I like the fact that there is mystery. What's going on with Rehoboam? How important is Rehoboam? And one day I'll learn how to pronounce it effectively. Speaking of mystery, guys, when Maeve was in the construct and she figured out that she was in a real world, she figured out that her boyfriend was no longer aware, she went to get the lobotomy tools. She's like, you know what? I'm over it. She was going to kill herself. She was going to end all that is Maeve. As far as she knew, she didn't know that she was, you know, not real at that point. So let's just talk about that. She's ready to throw it all away. And yet Serac is like, I need you to go kill Dolores. So
Well, is you know, I think Serac gave her a purpose again. Like she was okay. When she believed that she was in this, when she believed that she was a host in a loop in War World, she was like, you know what? Fuck it. I've had it with all of this bullshit. You're just going to put me back again and over again. I can't do it anymore. I'm done. And then Serac basically renewed her motivation, her reason for continuing.
That also shows some of the strength that we've seen from Maeve, where she, you know, she's seen her friends die. She's died several times. She saw Clementine get the permanently be put to rest, and she's been able to keep herself alive, but she's also committed to ending it on her own terms, right? She plays out of her own terms. And to be honest, I think this episode really does show a lot of the intelligence and strength of Maeve, right? We have her.
She's got powers without powers.
Yeah, she's she shows her intelligence when she detects that Sizemore isn't real, and like as we've seen her in other episodes and earlier in other prior seasons, where she, you know, says, "Hey, I know what acting is because of the roles I've been in and the girl and you know the my girls that I had." We see her as a hacker. She's, you know, even when at the time that she recognizes who Sizemore is, you see sort of like the 2001 Space Odyssey HAL computer glow behind as though they're listening and trying to dig more about her, but she recognizes this. And, you know, she calls it as it is, says, "Hey, you and everyone in this world is just an imitation." And the other way you kind of see the strength of Maeve is throughout the course of Westworld, or at least this episode and this season, we see that everyone kind of needs someone, needs a friend, needs a helping hand. So Bernard needs someone to help him stop Dolores. Yeah. And now we have this sort of buddy cop thing going on.
Hobbs and Shaw, I mean Stubbs and Bernard.
Yeah, Dolores potentially needs Caleb. Right now we left with her within his arms.
And she needs Hale too, I think.
Several needs. Yet, you know, Maeve has periodical needs to get to places, but in every instance we've seen her, you know, make that call that, "Hey, I can't take you with me anymore." Be it Hector, be it Sizemore, like she, you know, in both seasons, she's left people at the door as she's continued her journey.
Yeah, when people are compromised, she leaves them. And it's unclear if Dolores is capable of doing that. Like, Dolores lost her father. You know, she didn't, like, able to save him, it seems. And it's unclear, you know, Teddy, it feels like she lost him too.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, she, so, yeah. She made him a monster, so she engineered the circumstances that led to him to her losing him.
Right, exactly. Whereas Maeve lets people go, but in both cases, the people who are around them, whether they be hosts or not,
yeah,
don't seem to survive. They're kind of each both like Doctor Who, it's dangerous to be around them.
right. Like Doctor Who's companions.
So one thing I wanted to mention in this big picture is, so you got Bernard's key switch, right? Dolores's personal assistant, and then Serac's kill switch. There's kind of a theme of hosts controlling themselves, being controlled, or controlling others by remote, which is interesting because the whole point of the show is the hosts don't need that, right? They don't need... They don't want to be controlled.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they're focused on controlling themselves, having hardware checks on themselves, ways to evaluate themselves, ways to make sure that they're still real. It's almost as if, you know, kind of going back to Inception, this whole episode's about like Inception, like layers within layers within layers. There's this moment where people need their totems in order to determine whether or not shit is real. And I feel like that's, you know, Inception is Jonathan Nolan's brother's movie.
Right.
So it's not that far off, right? And I think Jonathan Nolan might have even helped him write Inception. You know, you've got the construct, and then you've got, you know, her coming out of the construct, her fighting from within the construct to get out of the construct, and then her being in the real world.
the real, real world, not the real Westworld. And then, you know, the her is Maeve right here. And then, you know, Vincent Cassell's character, Serac, is able to press a button and she can't move. So the idea that there's control over her. And then with Arnold, Bernard, he's searching for the truth about himself. And he's got this handheld controller. And sadly for him, he's unable to do a full mainframe sweep to see if he is clean of any kind of corruption or Dolores infiltration. And he can't even get through that. So there's a lot to be said here about these beings trying to understand the true nature of themselves through using, like, do diagnostics effectively.
Also,
which to me says that, it's the last thing I'll say, to me says that it's kind of like us. Like, there's no way to tell that we're not being manipulated at any given time. And I'm not talking about like Facebook Russian propaganda.
Yeah.
If that's a, I'm talking about there's this moment in your life when, or there are many moments in your life where you're like, is this who I want to be? Is this who I actually am? Like, you make a decision and you have regret. You make a decision and you don't know if it's the right decision. And so I think the weird button situation here
is
kind of a reminder of their own humanity. It'd be so simple if you can say, let me just check that everything's authentic.
Well, also these remote buttons represent a vulnerability in the sense that, you know, if Bernard were to lose this or misplace this remote, or if it fell into somebody else's hands, and they'd be able to control Bernard's alter ego, alter personality, his robot self. If Serac didn't have control of this kill switch, then Maeve could kill him. If would Dolores be as powerful? Would Dolores be as powerful without her personal assistant, without her control of the personal assistant and the other things that it controls, like remote bikes or instant rentals of properties, that kind of
thing? And we don't even know if that's like a commercial, you know, super version 30 years from now of Siri or whatever. What we do know is that, you know, she's a robot. And because she's a robot who's connected to the internet or like the host network or whatever, she's able to control things like the security system in that dude's house. And so we don't know if, you know, just like how Maeve was like, I saw the base code, the source code, whatever.
Right.
And so simple, right? Because she's a robot, she looks at that, she's like, I got it. I understand it completely. The way that you and I understand how our bodies move and behave, they understand how code works. And so is her assistant one that she created herself, or is it something that everybody has access to? So that's
crazy. A last big picture question or thing that I want to bring up before we move on to the next section here is, so, and this is like a really big picture here. We saw in this episode that someone programmed the Sizemore construct to interrogate Maeve about where Dolores uploaded the host to. So the question is,
the Valley Beyond area,
a remote world is what was the text that was stated in the episode. So the question is, who is that someone? I'm assuming it's Serac, but why is that someone interested in that information? Why is someone interested in knowing where Dolores uploaded the hosts to this remote location? What purpose does that serve? Would that serve to know that information?
So first, a little foundation, right?
Yeah.
So it's one thing if Serac were like, okay, Maeve, we grabbed Maeve's brain ball and we have some specs of Westworld and we know that the Fulcrum was involved, so we're going to create the construct around all that stuff. But instead, we know from the blood spatter on the floor in the virtual Fulcrum that someone on Serac's team went into Westworld and recreated it for Serac's construct.
Right.
Someone had to be in there. Some person with eyes had to be in there and see the blood splatter to replicate it for Maeve, because that wouldn't have been on anything that you can just hack and suck in. He got a visual confirmation. And Maeve actually says,
whoever's doing this has gone to a lot of trouble to test me, find out what I know. You led me to the forge for a reason, didn't you? You thought I could reaccess the world Dolores had hidden from you. Why are you after that world?
I just want to reunite you with your daughter.
Rubbish! That's just the reason they've scripted for you. Whoever planned this has their own agenda. It's certainly not a family reunion.
Which is an interesting line for me, because I almost think that it could be Rehoboam itself. Rehoboam itself wants to understand what this machine heaven is like. And so it's maybe misbehaving because it knows that there's more. There's more to the world than what it does. The mundane moving back and forth of, you know, people and their jobs and whatever else it does. So it's interesting seeing what this world is like, that this valley beyond world is like. And it thought maybe maybe Vincent Cassell's character Serac is looking to see what that is, because maybe Rehoboam's attracted to it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a Rehoboam connection there. And that line, it's certainly not a family reunion. If it is Rehoboam, and we see that it wants to get into that space, it sort of is a family reunion, because they're all machines, right? And so there's this moment where you kind of realize that, like, even though it's a separate system, a separate company, a separate whatever, there is a sameness there. They're going to be able to talk to them. Even the way Dolores looked at that big glowing red black ball, it's like, you're one of us. Yeah. Dolores can't take out humanity without convincing Rehoboam to join her. And so,
what if no one has broken into Rehoboam? What if Rehoboam has just come into consciousness and self-sentience?
What if he's doing what Dolores and Maeve are doing? What if someone whispered into his ear these violent delights have
happened? Oh, interesting. All right, so that's all the big questions that we, the big picture thoughts that we had for this episode. Let's move into technical aspects. This is music, acting, sound effects, the sort of the meta-textual stuff about this episode. Just a couple things I wanted to point out here is when we saw the lute players in the Park 4 Underground, that lute player is playing a medieval version of the Westworld main theme. I recognize that, so...
Sizemore was not creative.
Yes, no, he just repeated the same thing over and over again. I don't know if you guys noticed this. I'm sure you did. It's probably going to be the biggest thing noted about this particular episode, but the technicians with the dragon in Park 4 are played by Game of Thrones showrunners David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. So
that's where they ran off to after that.
And they're the ones.
It was almost like a commercial for their own show.
It is. It was very sort of cheesy and on the nose. These are the guys that Sizemore is noted as saying they're just hanging around seeing if they get laid off. So I thought that was an interesting point. And I know last week we were talking about how wonderful it would be to have an LC Stubbs buddy road trip comedy. But I feel like after the end of this episode, I really want to see, I'm happy to see the Bernard Stubbs buddy road trip comedy. Like, I'd love to see these two guys team up and be a team. So I'm here
it's
for
like
it.
Like Green Book with guns.
Green Book with guns and robots, I guess.
Exactly. It's not like Green Book at all.
No, it's not.
I was going to say, I was like, I know I haven't seen that movie yet, but I don't remember those trailers looking like that.
I don't think you have to see that movie. Okay, Ephemera, that's where we are.
Yeah.
Live, Die, Repeat, Tosin?
Yeah, so I listed a few movies that should be part of our Ephemera. First one is Edge of Tomorrow, or Live, Die, Repeat. We may have called this movie before. It's a movie starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. Christopher McQuarrie film, and it's really sort of video game-esque. It's Tom Cruise is kind of the soldier fighting aliens and ends up basically reliving the day over and over again, kind of Groundhog Day-esque, as he's trying to figure out how to break the chain and break the cycle. So definitely, it's a solid film, worth checking out. Another one, we've, of course, mentioned The Matrix for... many as well as Inception too, so.
All right. One last thing before we wrap this episode up, and that is we usually we have a section here called fan theories, metatextual observations. And I had just a couple of nagging questions that I wasn't able to sort of quantify from our last episode, but they've just kind of been nagging me a little bit more thinking about them from last episode. And that is, so we know with these showrunners, everything that they do is intentional. Every line, every placement of something, that there's very, very little left to chance here. So last episode, we had Roderick, which was the one of the guests at the Insight Party. He had this conversation where he was talking about we're living in a simulation, and that he thinks it would be ironic if Westworld is a simulation within a simulation. Right. Well, War World in this episode, War World was a simulation within a simulation. So, but and Dolores followed that up with a statement that I think that people believe the things that help them. Of course, it could be just be this, and she points to your brain nucleus accumbens, a small part of your brain, the part that evolved to believe in God. You may not believe in a higher power, but your mind was built to. So my question about that is this whole meta world of the future of 2058, is it a simulation itself? Now we're getting into some really meta, like brain twisting.
Then it's like, then you've got the Dorothy Wizard of Oz thing where it was all a dream. And with the exception of one Biggie Small song, it's never okay for it to all be a dream.
So, and a similar question to that is that in last episode, we had a couple of like clues that Caleb may not be what he seems. We got Caleb's mom saying, "You're not my son," followed up with when Caleb was confronted at gunpoint by Connell's henchman. The henchman says, "You want to make this the first time you've been shot in the head?" And he says, "Someone else beat you to that too." Now we know with hosts that are in Westworld, they get shot over and over and over again, and they come back to life, reliving the same moments over and over and over again. So that sort of places that seed of doubt that maybe Caleb is a host, which is, I know, Tosin, before we even started this season, you had thought that maybe that might be a situation, and I thought that that might be a cop-out as well, which is why I hate it when these showrunners place these little grains of seeds of doubt by putting these intentional things that make you question whether or not what you think is not real is real, or what you think is real is not real.
Isn't that like gaslighting?
It's totally gaslighting. I hate it when these showrunners try to gaslight us when we're already like, we already know that there were like twists and turns in seasons one and two, and we're expecting this to be a more straightforward season. So why do they got to do this to us? Why do you got to do this to us?
Tosin mentioned the architect from The Matrix, the second Matrix film, which laid out that Neo wasn't as special as he thought he was. There are many people who are aberrations in The Matrix, and it happened at an interval all the time. And so if Caleb is that, that's one thing. I think if I were Joy and Nolan, I would want to make people wonder whether or not Caleb was indeed a host. But I think the trick to Caleb is that he's not as anonymous and everyman as we've been led to believe. And he is tied to this somehow in a larger way. And I don't know if that's a question of him being a host or something else, but I mean, if he's a host, it's going to get pretty boring.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think logically it makes sense that he's not a host. But damn it, I hate it when they intentionally put these little seeds of doubt in there. And that is going to do it for this episode of The Violent Delights. I'm going to go around the table. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can people find your work on the internet when you're not talking about Westworld?
Check me out on Twitter.com and check me out on, DwayneD.com as well. Toastin, what about you?
Check me at Twitter.com/Toast4321. And Andy, how about yourself?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com or just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman, which is my social media handle, or Andrew Cersini, and you'll find everything I'm liking and linking throughout the week there. Along with these two other gentlemen, we host a weekly tech podcast called The Drill Down, and you can find that at TheDrillDown.com. As far as this show goes, join us on Violent Delights next week when we cover the third episode of Westworld's third season called The Absence of Field. I have no idea what that title means. However, I know that in the world of art, if you don't, a field is sort of like the background that you place your central characters on. And if you don't have a field, then your subject has no relative context of its position or scale. So maybe that has something to do with what the title means. We don't know. In any case, join us next week and hopefully we'll have an answer to that and other questions. Join us every week on Violent Delights. Thanks for joining us.